B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who has both casual and formal golf shoes, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. This is the first of two vacation weeks for the show as I recharge the batteries getting ready for the season's final major, the Open Championship. If you're a summer book reader, I've got three great suggestions for you this week. We will revisit conversations with Chris Rodell, who's written a fantastic book on Arnold Palmer's lifelong love and residency in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. With John Feinstein, renowned author of golf nonfiction, but has a great fictional read with some characters based in reality. But we begin with my favorite subject. They say you can take the boy out of Texas, but you never take Texas out of the boy. I've now almost been gone from my home state as long as I was there, but I'll always have a soft spot in my heart for golfers from the Lone Star State, specifically Ben Hogan. He's, to me, the greatest ball striker of all time and the man I named my son after. There have been lots of biographies written about the man and a great documentary recently on the Golf Channel, but Tim Scott's book on Bantam Ben definitely stands on its own. Tim, the book that you've written about Ben Hogan, we've discussed this off the air, is unique to me in its voice. There's been great biographies written of the man. Kurt Sampson wrote one. James Dotson wrote one. But yours seems to have a different voice because it's a personal thing. You actually knew Ben Hogan. In fact, you worked for him. When did you go to work for Ben?
1969. And I was there through 1982.
What did you do before you went to work for the Ben Hogan Golf Equipment Company?
Well, I was in graduate school, and interesting, I had won the Dartmouth. I went to the Tuck School, the business school at Dartmouth, and I had won the all-campus tournament. And my second year there, I went down to work in the kitchen, and some of my classmates knew I played golf, so they said, "Did you talk to AMF today?" And I said, "No, it's a bowling company. I don't want to talk to them." They said, no, they're looking for an assistant to the president of the Ben Hogan Company. Well, I don't know if my feet ever hit the floor between that conversation and getting my resume and getting up to the interview room, but luckily I caught the interviewer just as he was leaving, and he said he was coming back the next day to interview some first-year students for internships. And in my interview the next day, he told me that a Dartmouth guy was going to get that job. He was a Dartmouth alum, and but a Dartmouth guy was going to get it, and I ended up getting the position.
So how long was it before you started working at the company, before you, because I'm sure as a golfer, you were intimidated by the mere thought of being in the room with Ben Hogan, not knowing him, but just knowing him by reputation only. What was it like that first time you came face-to-face with the man?
Well, they actually sent me on a one-year training program at AMF's Sports Products Group in Stamford, Connecticut. And my position there was to work on a five-year plan for each of the business units. And so I went to the Hogan Company and was introduced to him during that year. And the other thing was that, of course, I was very intimidated at that, but I worked with an engineer up there who was working on a project for the Hogan Company to develop the apex shaft. And he was a PhD metallurgist from Carnegie Tech. He was filling me in with all the information about Mr. Hogan and how they were working together on the shaft. So I had a little bit of personal background before I went down there. And obviously I asked him, "What kind of guy is he?" And he said, "Well, you know, he's very smart and very focused, but he's a great guy." So I wasn't as intimidated just to talk to him. Now, when the first time I ever encountered him on the golf course was a totally different thing. We were playing, and the company always had a golf tournament the last day of the sales meeting. And that year, 1969, Mr. Hogan had surgery on his shoulder. So he wasn't playing. And the sales VP told us all, you know, just to give us a heads up that Hogan was going to get in the cart and drive out along the golf course and visit with us. Well, on the third hole, and I played pretty well, But on the third hole, I teed my ball up, and as I straightened up about 2 feet from the tee marker, there was a wheel from a cart. I looked up to see a familiar face in a white hat, and I thought I was having a heart attack. I mean, if I hadn't been 25 years old and in very good shape, I would have thought I was having a heart attack. I've never been so choked in my life.
Was it a prerequisite if you went to work for the Hogan Company that you be a decent golfer?
No, not necessarily. Now, in the sales, in the salesman, it was preferred because then they could talk the lingo of the golf professionals. And back then, we only sold through the golf professional shops. And also, they could understand the technical details of the benefits of the various aspects of a golf club, the shaft and the way the head was designed and how all that related to the performance of the club. So for a salesperson, yeah, that was an advantageous thing to have. As far as people in my marketing department, I had people in there that weren't golfers necessarily.
Tim Scott is the author of the book, Ben Hogan, The Myths Everyone Knows, The Man No One Knew. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. I like how you've written the book in that it's a series of stories, not just by you, but by other people that came in and out of Hogan's life, sort of debunking some myths. One of my favorites is this myth, and this is the one that you hear a lot. Ben Hogan was a man without feelings or wit, a hollow, empty man. And you say that's completely false.
Totally. He was a very private person. And I think one of the reasons that he was very private was that when he was 9 years old, his father committed suicide. And from my understanding, little Ben walked into the room just as his father shot himself.
Yeah.
That was a deep, dark family secret. In fact, Valley Hogan, Ben's wife, never knew it until after they were married. And she only found it out then by accident when she walked into a room Hogan's mother and sister were having a conversation, and she, picked up on it and said, well, what's this all about? And they finally told her what the deal was. But I think that was an underlying factor as to not being very outgoing, because he never wanted to have that question asked or discussed.
But to the people that knew him, another word that I heard a lot, and I had the fortune of talking with Ken Venturi many years before he died, but he used a word to describe Hogan, and that word is loyal. If you were his friend and you were loyal to him, he was loyal to you forever. And I know that there's a good deal in the book about his relationship with Marvin Leonard. And Marvin Leonard founded Colonial Country Club. Talk a little bit about Ben's relationship with him.
After his father committed suicide, he and his older brother, Royal, had to go out and help earn money to pay for the family bills. And so they started out as newspaper boys, and that was a pretty rough business back then. I mean, Hogan was small for his age, and so he got picked on. If he happened to find a good corner to sell newspapers, the bigger boys, got wind of it, and they come along and try to push him out of the spot. It wasn't long after that he found out he could make as much money caddying over at Glen Garden Country Club. Not long after he did that, he still had the same problem with the older boys beating up on him or trying to intimidate him, until he finally whipped one of the bigger boys pretty handily, and they didn't bother him after that. But somehow he and Marvin Leonard met, and Mr. Leonard had been told by his doctors that he needed to take up golf and get away from the office, or he's going to kill himself. So he started playing golf every morning, and me and Ben got together, and Ben would be out there as soon as the sun came up to caddy for Marvin. And so he played 9 holes before he went to work and before Ben went to school. And they did that over a full year or so of almost every day. And they got to be pretty good friends. And then when Hogan started out on the tour, a couple of times he ran out of money, and Mr. Leonard gave him some. But I think one of the most endearing things that I ever heard personally was that when Hogan started the Ben Hogan Company, that he had a partner, and the first batch of woods that they made, Mr. Hogan didn't like them. So he told his partner they shouldn't sell him, and the partner wanted to sell him as rejects and get some money out of him. He said, no, I don't want to start the company that way. So one of one night he went down to the company and cut all the heads off of them with a bandsaw. Well, then his partner obviously got upset and said, well, we can't do this. Either you buy me out or I buy you out, but this ain't gonna work. So he went back to Colonial, was sitting there at the bar kind of with dejectedly and head down, just kind of looking at the bar. Mr. Leonard walked over and said, what's the matter, Ben? You don't look very happy. And he said, no. And so he told him what the story was. Next thing he knew, he went back to his drink and looking at the bar. And the next thing he knew, Mr. Leonard had slid something over to him. He glanced at it, and it was a check made out to him, but the amount was blank. He said, Marvin, I can't accept this. He said, no, you need to accept this. I want you to get that business started so you have full control over your name. And so he said, well, don't you want to know how much I need? And he said, no, you just make sure you get enough to buy the company and have enough to get started on. You don't just buy the company and then you're short of cash. You take what you need. You know, Mr. Leonard obviously was kind of the father that Ben never had.
Tim Scott is the author of the book Ben Hogan, The Myths Everyone Knows, The Man No One Knew. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. He took great pride, obviously, just based on the story you just told, in anything that went out with his name on it. You were with the company from 69 until 82. How hands-on was Ben Hogan at the time you were there? The story you just told was in the late 40s, early 50s. How hands-on at the time you were there was Ben Hogan?
He wasn't involved in the day-to-day operations, although he was in charge of the quality, so he could shut the plant down anytime he wanted to, or shut a portion of it down anytime he wanted to. And there are several stories in the book about him doing that. I mean, on one occasion, he was walking back through the plant, and there was a cart of woods there, and so he pulled one off the rack and looked at it, and he didn't like it. And so he took that wood, and he raised his arm clear up, you know, so it was over his head with the wood in it, and he slammed it down into the concrete and shattered it, and of course, it made a big racket, and everybody kind of perked up to see what was going on. They saw it was Hogan, so they immediately got back to work, you know, very diligently on whatever they were supposed to be doing. But then he had a meeting call, and he said, I don't care if we only make one club a day. We're not making anything like this anymore. And that's the way it was. I mean, he was very, very quality conscious, and he had a very sharp eye for equipment. Gene Shealy, our model maker, took me into Hogan's office one day. He said, I've got a driver I want to use to show Ben. I want you to come in with me. And so we walked in there, and he handed the driver to Hogan, and he looked down at it, stood up behind his desk. He had that plastic so that his chair would roll on the carpet, and set that head on the plastic and looked down at it and kind of gripped it, and then he handed it back to Gene, and he said, Gene, I think this club's a little too long. Gene says, oh, no, Ben, it's the right length. He said, I think you better check it, Ben. So Gene and I walked out of the office, and my office was across the entry to the Hogan Company, so the main foyer was up there, and we got about two-thirds of the way across that, and he said, oh, damn. And I said, what's the matter, Gene? He said, that club's a 32nd of an inch too long, and Hogan picked up on it.
Wow.
Now, we're talking about a driver that was 43 and one-quarter inch long, and he picked up the difference of a 32nd of an inch.
Wow. Get you out of here on this. Tim, what was something, even though you worked with him for all of those years, what was something that you found out through the course of your research and talking to other people about Hogan that even surprised you?
Well, one of the things that surprised me is that I heard about it before I had a personal incident happen, was that he was very good with children. You know, to take the public image that he had back then about being selfish and non-caring, not feeling rude, a mechanical person. You never thought anybody like that would be good with kids, but boy, he was great with children. And there's one personal story in there about my son and me that we had just finished shooting a commercial. After the commercial, there was a group of us standing around, including Mr. Hogan, talking about how the shoot went and what things, you know, he thought ought to be emphasized and so on and so forth. And my little boy, who was about three at the time, came up and we're talking, and my son janks on my pant leg and says, and I kind of shook my head no, and I did that a couple of times. And finally I said, Jordan, what do you want? And he said, I'm thirsty. I said, well, not now, later. And so he kind of came back at me, and finally Mr. Hogan said, come on, Jordan, I'll get you a Coke. So he Jordan's hand, and they walked over, got on his cart, and he drove him around to get a Coke in the dining room, and came back a little bit later, and so we're starting to talk again, and my son kind of jerks on my pant leg again, and he said, Dad, and I looked down, and I shook at him, and then he finally just said, what's my toothies? I said, what? And then I looked at Mr. Hogan, and so he stood there with a big grin on his face, and he tapped his front tooth, and he said, I didn't want him to be drinking out of that bottle while we were driving on the cart, because I was afraid we'd hit a bump and he might break one of his little toothies.
So the Hawk, the Iceman, Ben Hogan used a word like toothies?
He did. I mean, it broke us all up, because once he said, I was afraid he might break one of his little toothies, we all just cracked up on him, because that's something that, you know, just everybody doesn't use.
The book, Ben Hogan, The Myths Everyone Knows, The Man No One Knew, the author, Tim Scott. And when we return, John Feinstein takes dead aim at a fictional story in the game of golf that I think could really happen. It's called The Prodigy, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. John Feinstein has written tomes about the Ryder Cup, U.S. Open, Q School, Tiger Woods, and much more in the game of golf. However, for this conversation we had towards the end of last year, we were talking about his work of fiction, The Prodigy. So ever since Bo Hostler went into the lead at the Olympic Club as a high school sophomore several years ago at the U.S. Open, I've had this wild notion, this fantasy, if you will, that amateur golf has gotten so good in this country, and kids are getting so good, so battle-hardened, so polished at such an early age, that it doesn't stretch credulity for me to imagine one actually being in contention at a U.S. Open, at a Masters, at an Open Championship on the weekend. Of course, that's a theme in your book, The Prodigy. Do you think it could happen, or am I just crazy?
No, I don't think you're crazy at all, Charlie, and that's part of the reason why I put together this plot in The Prodigy, because maybe you have to suspend disbelief a little bit to think that a 17-year-old could be in contention on Sunday at the Masters. But remember, the British Open in 2015 at St. Andrews, you had an amateur in the lead after 54 holes, and you had five amateurs in the top 10 after 54 holes, all very young players. Now, none of them won. Zach Johnson ended up winning, as we know. But more and more, you're right, we're seeing young players who have played so much amateur golf and so much college golf come to the fore early in their pro careers, or even while they're still amateurs. Jordan Spieth finished T16 at the Byron Nelson when he was 16 in high school. And Ty Tryon, years ago, made it through PGA Tour Q School when he was 17. Probably shouldn't have turned pro, probably should have gone to college, but he was good enough to compete with pros at the age of 17. So when I was writing The Prodigy, my thought was, a 17-year-old competing to win the Masters, not likely, but not completely impossible. And that's why throughout the book, you know, I keep quoting Rory McIlroy, who's one of the real people who appears in the book, is saying, hey, you know what? This kid's good enough to win now, not in 5 years or 10 years. He's good enough to win now, because it's not crazy to say something like that.
You mentioned Ty Tryon. To me, he's the ultimate cautionary tale. And you said, you know, he probably should have gone to college. That's something that's repeated over and over again throughout your book, as the prodigy Frank, all he really wants to do is play golf and to go play college golf. And he states it over and over again. And time and again, whether it be Brent Snedeker or other people in the world of golf mentioned to him, Tom Watson, whoever, they all tell him, hey, go to college, go to college. Right. Is this a universal that you witness out there that regardless of how good the kid is, all of them say, man, don't grow up so fast. Go to college.
Yes. And I'll tell you why, because it isn't so much about your ability to play golf inside the ropes. Ty Tryon was good enough, as we said, to get through Q school. There have been other teenagers who have turned pro and been good enough as golfers to compete. But even Tiger Woods, the greatest player of all time, went to Stanford for 2 years and still had all sorts of issues, as we now know, off the golf course at the age of 20. So I don't think there's any doubt. The thing that players say all the time is, if you're good enough, you don't need to turn pro at the age of 18. There's no big rush. And, you know, there's always the temptation if people are throwing a lot of money at you, whether it's, Nike or any of the big-time shoe companies or any corporate sponsor or people who want to pay you guarantees to play overseas. Sure, that money is tempting, especially for parents. But long-term, if you're thinking long-term about your kid's future, then you don't turn him pro that early. Look what happened to Michelle Wee, you know, who was so good at the age of 13 and turned pro before she went to college and was miserable out there. Only after she went to Stanford did she sort of get her act together and become not a great player because she can't putt, but a good player. Lexi Thompson is somewhat of an exception to the rule. I thought she turned pro too young, but she's been able to handle most of the pressure out there. But she would be the outlier in that.
John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I'm glad you brought up the equipment companies. In a lot of ways, there are themes throughout The Prodigy that read like a cautionary tale. I knew that equipment companies had access to amateurs and can set them up with equipment. One thing that I was unaware of was the access that agents have to kids when they're amateurs. They can come on legally as quote unquote advisors.
Right.
How much of this is actually going on?
Oh, a lot.
Oh, wow.
A lot. I mean, you see all sorts of play. You know, if you go to the NCAA tournament, for example, or if you go to the U.S. Amateur, probably a better example even, you will see agents everywhere. And again, as you said, the rules don't prevent them from having contact with the players. I mean, one of the dumbest things that the NCAA is about to do in basketball is to give agents more access to players than they've had in the past. The theory being that way the sleazy agents won't have an advantage by contacting players while the non-sleazy agents are playing by the rules. Well, I understand that theory, but even the non-sleazy agents are sleazy, Charlie. You know that.
Yes.
So here, excuse me, and in golf, as you said, and as the book says, it's not against the rules. In fact, you know the thing in the book where Frank Baker's dad, Thomas, is going on the payroll of the mythical group Double Eagles, Double Eagle Inc., as a, quote, junior talent scout. That's based on truth.
Because
that's
Earl Woods. Yeah.
Was a talent scout for IMG, quote, unquote, while Tiger was in high school. And the big joke in golf is, hey, he did his job very well. He delivered the greatest junior in history.
I'm glad you brought up the Thomas Baker. He, to me, is one of the most interesting characters in your book. And maybe it's because I'm a dad and my kid plays golf. But at his core, he seems to be a good man who loves his son. They've been a two-man team, basically raised him as a single father. Yet he is the one, not the player, he is the one that is seduced by the dark side of the force, by these advisors. And all his son wants to do is play golf and go to college. I know that this all comes from experience. You write from experience. Is it as sleazy in person to watch these vultures come between families as it is to read?
Yeah, it can be painful because the point I was trying to make in creating Thomas Baker, who in many ways is a composite of many parents, is that you can understand the temptation. You know, when people are throwing money at your feet, people are telling you how great you are, people are telling you how great your child is and how they're going to take care of your child and they're going to make your child a star and you're going to be able to retire and never work again. You can understand the tempting notion there. But this, with Thomas Baker, I think most parents genuinely love their kids and want what's best for their kids, but they can get blinded by what is being thrown at their feet and by people charming them and sucking up to them and telling them how great they are and that they're never wrong about anything. So I tried in the book to depict the fact that Thomas Baker, the father, is in many ways kind of a tortured figure because the money is dazzling him. There's no question about it. And he's thinking, I can retire. I can buy a big house in Florida. I can just play golf. I have people lapping up to me all the time. But on the other hand, he's got his son saying, Dad, I don't want this. This isn't what I want. I want to play golf. I love to play golf. But I want to go to college. I want to be a normal kid. I want to date girls. I want to have a childhood. And that's the danger, is that kids lose their childhoods. And it's not unique to golf. It's worse in tennis. I mean, you have all sorts of tennis players turning pro. In fact, I always ask this trivia question. Do you know who the last American player, male player, to win a Grand Slam tournament who was a college graduate is? If you do, you're very unusual.
McEnroe?
Arthur Ashe.
Ashe.
Who graduated from UCLA in 1963.
Wow.
And I remember asking John McEnroe once why he played Davis Cup all the time. And he said he made his mother two promises when he was in high school. One was to graduate from college, and the other was to play Davis Cup. And he said, when I dropped out of Stanford after my freshman year, I figured I damn well better play Davis Cup.
John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy, our guest taking dead aim. John, golf is as fiction, I think it's harder to write than other sports because a field is a field. A basketball court, a football gridiron, a baseball diamond. On the field of play, they are unchanged no matter where you are in the world. Golf is different. Every course is different. And I got to give you great credit here because the two courses in your book are Riviera and Augusta National, especially Augusta. We all know every nook and cranny of every hole, so it's easy to envision all the action you describe. And the holes that you chose to use at Riviera are iconic ones as well, especially number 10. Was this done on purpose and with that intent in mind?
Absolutely. I hope this book will have broad appeal, but I know a lot of its appeal is going to be to golf fans. And one of the things as a reader that I have always enjoyed in fiction is to read it and say, yeah, I've been to the Final Four, so this looks and sounds like a Final Four. I've been to Wimbledon. This looks and sounds like Wimbledon. So in writing fiction about golf, I want a golf fan to say, yeah, I know what you mentioned, the 10th hole of Riviera is like. That's always a big featured hole every year during the tournament there because it's one of the great short par fours in golf, as is number 3 at Augusta National. So I wanted to describe these holes in a way that a golf fan who's either watched on TV or played at Riviera or played at Augusta, if they've been lucky enough to do that, could sit back and go, yeah, that's right. People who watch the Masters every year would say, yeah, the hole location on Sunday is always front left on 18. So that it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. I've covered 27 Masters. I've been to Riviera on many occasions. So I hope I know what I'm talking about.
Just off subject for a second, is it a more fun or calming exercise for you to write fiction than what you normally do in doing the great nonfiction work that you do?
It's very different, Charlie. I'm lucky. I enjoy both. I think by doing both, it keeps me fresh because I'll finish grinding out a nonfiction book. Like I have a book coming out on quarterbacking in the NFL in November. And then I know for a while I don't have to go on the road. I don't have to set up interviews. I don't have to try to get people to give me, large chunks of their time because when I write the fiction, my reporting is based, is done because my reporting is based on my career and all the years I've spent knowing athletes and coaches and going to all these events we're talking about. And then the challenge is different. The challenge is coming up with a storyline that people are going to want to follow. So I like having a different challenge. I also like the idea that for a few months my office every day is right here in my house as opposed to going on the road somewhere. I'm old, Charlie. I like being at home.
John Feinstein is author of The Prodigy, our guest taking dead aim. Back to the book for a second. You did change some names, especially where Augusta National was concerned, yep. Much to a big smile on my face, having lived and worked in Augusta for 5.5 years. But there are many real names with actual dialogue and situations used. Did you ask permission in advance, or did you get sort of a tentative okay, but let me read it first? How did you go about that?
When dealing with real characters in all my fiction, almost always they're people I'm friendly with or friends with, and people who I know won't object to having a fictional role in one of my books. Now, I will give them a heads up. You know, I will say, for example, one of the less famous people in the book is Steve DiMeglio from USA Today.
I loved that, by the way.
And Steve's a buddy of mine. And as you notice, every time he appears, the last thing he says is, "I gotta go smoke." And that's because that is always the last thing Steve says to you when you have a conversation with him. So, of course, I gave him a heads up. I gave not only gave Rory McIlroy a heads up, I gave him a copy of the book. And I said, there's a surprise ending. I think you'll like it. But I didn't tell him what it was.
Right.
You know, and all the other guys who appear, from USGA officials, Mike Davis, people like that, to other players, Zach Johnson, Justin Rose, Tom Watson, you mentioned, who, as you know, I'm very close to. I gave them all a heads up that they appear in the book. And I also make sure when I'm dealing with real characters that they don't do anything objectionable.
Right.
Like, I would not have a real character be involved in the incident that takes place at the U.S. Amateur, obviously, in the semifinals. That person had to be fictionalized. And I fictionalized the Augusta National members because, as you know, I kind of make fun of them in the book. And I figure, why get into any kind of battle with them other than saying, hey, fellas, come on, we should all be able to have a good laugh about this. But maybe they'll kick me out. Who knows?
I don't want to give too much away here, but there's a John Feinstein-esque journalist, maybe a young John Feinstein-esque journalist.
Except this guy's a much better golfer than John Feinstein.
He's a big part of the story, and you already brought it up, the fictional playing of the U.S. Amateur, where he, in a couple of ways, becomes unwittingly part of the story.
Right.
The second part is the most egregious, and like I said, I'm not going to give anything away here, but have you ever witnessed a rules infraction or felt like really one may have taken place and you did nothing?
And where I did nothing.
Yes.
Nothing on that level, that's for sure.
Yeah.
There have been moments where I've seen things happen and wondered if I witnessed a rules infraction. And would, you know, eventually ask a rules official, this is what I think I saw, was it a rules infraction? And almost all the time it's not. Players usually know what they're doing. But if I ever witness something like what takes place in Los Angeles in the book, I would feel obligated to do what my fictional character does in the book. You can't allow that to pass if somebody's cheating. I mean, it's an incident involving out-and-out cheating. Most of the time, as you know, when rules get broken, it's inadvertent.
Yes. You rarely, like, again, we're going to give too much away, and I promised I wouldn't do that. John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy, our guest taking dead aim. The authenticity that permeates your book, I really enjoy, especially, I always like being able to pull back the curtain on Oz for people sometimes and tell them exactly the way things are. And in this case, I think you did this for all of us who have ever hung out in a media tent. You do a tremendous job in detailing the access that the media has with players and at the locations at which we have access at tournaments. Did you do this just as an homage for all of us who have suffered? Or are there places and events that you attend annually that you just loathe for this reason and you had to get it out of your system?
Well, I mean, as you know, Augusta is different than other golf tournaments because it's the only golf tournament in the world where we can't walk inside the ropes.
Right.
I mean, the Augusta National people are very firm on this. Nobody goes inside the ropes other than players and caddies. If a rules official is needed, they call for him or her, and then they come inside the ropes. We don't have access to the champions' locker room. We don't have access to the range or the putting green. It makes doing my job harder during Masters Week, frankly. But the people at the Masters have a very simple philosophy. It's our golf tournament. We run it the way we want to run it. And if you don't like the way we run it, you are welcome not to come.
That's exactly the
And frankly, I don't have a problem with that.
No.
I mean, it is their golf tournament.
Absolutely.
And as I said, it makes my job harder to do than other weeks on the golf tour. But I go there knowing that. So I go there prepared for that. And you know, I talk about the cell phone rule. In the book, I think the cell phone rule is a little bit ridiculous in today's world where, you know, literally I remember my friend Dave Kindred walking out of the media center one year and we were going to the parking lot. We were leaving and it was 7 o'clock in the evening, maybe later than that. And his wife called. And so instinctively he reached for his phone and he got two steps outside and was just about tackled. You know, and was fortunate not to. I mean, if they thrown him out that day, it wouldn't have mattered. But I just think they go a little over the top with some of their rules. But again, that's who they are. It's their tournament. If I never show up at Augusta again, believe me, nobody's going to bat an eye. I understand that.
Get you out of here on this. There's so many anecdotes and stories contained within the book, The Prodigy, that ring so true. At the risk of sounding ridiculous, I've got to ask about them. Number one is the great quote from the Palestra: "To win the game is great, to play the game is greater, but to love the game is the greatest of all." And Jordan Spieth incorporates this in a speech to the Drive Chip and Putt kids. It sounds like something so Jordan that I almost want to say this had to have happened. I know it didn't, but I had to ask: did it happen?
No, I made it up.
Oh, but doesn't that sound like something he would do, though, John?
Not only does it sound like something he said. He would say, but his brother did play at Brown.
Yes.
So he played in the Palestra for 4 years. So that would give the Spieth family familiarity with the Palestra. So I didn't think it was a stretch to put those words in Jordan's mouth. And I'll use any excuse to get the Palestra into a book because my wife has always said she's not afraid I will leave her for another woman, but she does worry sometimes I would leave her to move into the Palestra.
And the story of Mike Weir and the shower and hosting the Champions
Dinner.
That's
a true story.
Okay, that is so great. Can you just reiterate that real quick?
The year Mike Weir was the defending champion in 2004, and obviously the defending champion hosts the Champions Dinner on Tuesday night. He picks the menu. He's the host. You know that. That's part of a Masters legend. And on Tuesday night, Mike was on the range grinding on his swing because he was struggling a little bit. And he looked up and looked at his watch, and it was 6:30. The dinner starts at 7. And he went, oh, my God, you know, and he runs into the Champions locker room, which he was in for the first time that year, sweating and desperately needing a shower before he gets dressed. Well, the Champions locker room only has one shower in it because, you know, guys don't take showers all that often. But the night of the Champions dinner, he comes in. Arnold Palmer is in the shower. Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson are waiting for the shower. And as Weir said, that wasn't a line I felt I could cut. He had to wait until each of them was finished with their shower before he could get under the shower, probably for about 2 minutes, and get dressed for the dinner. Fortunately, he only had to walk a few steps to get to the dinner once he had showered. But no, that story's 100% true.
That was fantastic. One quick one here to end it. Your story to me ends on kind of a cliffhanger. Are we to assume that Frank is playing golf for Casey Martin at Oregon?
I think that's a good assumption to make. I do. I think that clearly he could go anywhere he wants. You hope that he'll be playing college golf. There's a little bit of a cliffhanger in that, as you point out. And I put Casey Martin in the book because he's been so successful as Oregon's golf coach, but also because I got to know Casey when I was doing my Q School book back in 2005 and when he was dealing with the Supreme Court on the golf cart issue. And I've never met a better guy in sports. So, again, I try to incorporate real people who I like and am friends with into these books. So it was kind of natural to put Casey in as a guy who might be recruiting Frank Baker to come play for him.
We just swapped messages on Twitter last week. One of the good guys and great writers in the game, John Feinstein.
And up next, our summer book tour wraps up with Chris Rodell taking dead aim at Arnold Palmer's life in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. There perhaps has never been or ever will be a more universally beloved person in golf than Arnold Palmer. He was born and lived his entire life in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and last year we spoke with author Chris Rodell about his book on this subject. Chris, before we dive into your book about Arnold Palmer, as a current resident of Latrobe, Pennsylvania, you have to answer a question for me that I've been dying to know for years.
Yes.
Fred Rogers was born in March of 1928. Arnold Palmer was born in September of 1929, both in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. So they're within a year class-wise of each other. You can make an argument that no two people from one place in the world have done more for children than Arnold Palmer and Fred Rogers.
That's
yet I never come across anything that has them working together on a project or being involved charitably together. Am I wrong, or did they really not have an involvement even though they were so charitable, both of them?
That's a great point. You know, searching my memory now, I can't recall any incident of that either. I do remember that Mr. Palmer was so competitive when I told him that Fred Rogers had won the Congressional Medal of Freedom prior to him. He seemed a little miffed.
Oh, my God.
He's the only guy in the world that would be competitive with Fred Rogers.
Oh, my God. That's a fantastic story. You know, Arnold is synonymous with Latrobe. Are there any shrines or anything to Mr. Rogers there? Just wondering.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a statue downtown and McFeely Rogers Park. So he's well represented and very beloved for all the same reasons as Mr. Palmer.
I've just always been curious about that, and I was searching and searching this morning to find a common cause in Latrobe or something that they worked together on. I couldn't even find a picture of them together.
No, I've seen one picture of them together, but they really didn't have that much to do with one another. It wasn't any hostility or anything. They were friendly, but their paths never crossed. I think part of it might have been that they were both two successful people working their own ways.
Oh, yeah, they were completely different personality-wise and field and everything else. I mean, I get that.
Yeah, so they didn't need to overlap to help the town. But that's a very good question. I'll have to talk to some people about that.
Chris Rodell is the author of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. One of the things that caught my eye immediately was a golf writer or someone who has written at the time in the world of golf in 1992 moves to Latrobe, Pennsylvania and does not start pestering Arnold Palmer. Did that raise more red flags than if you did go to pester Arnold Palmer?
No, they were very happy about that. They did not like being pestered. And I would show up there. I was doing those Amazing But True golf calendars, you know, those page-a-day things you tear off.
Loved them.
Yeah, and so did Arnold Palmer. He was like my number one fan. And I would drop them off at Christmas, one for Doc Giffen and one for Mr. Palmer. And then I would leave them alone. And eventually Doc called me up to golf. And we still didn't have a real breakthrough chumminess-wise until we got to the bar. And he said, Chris, what'll you have? And he's very austere and very proper. I said, I'll have a double Jack Daniels on the rocks, no straw. And he put his arm around me. He said, my man. That was my bourbon order.
You brought up a great name, Doc Giffen. Explain to people exactly who Doc Giffen was and who Doc Giffen is.
Well, first of all, he's the man that if anybody has the audacity to write a book about Arnold Palmer, it should be Doc Giffen. But he promised him years ago he'd never write a book and never betray any secrets like that. I never made that promise, and I said that I was lucky enough to be part of the solar system, but I was like Pluto, and people argue whether Pluto is even a planet. Doc Giffen is Earth. If Arnold was the sun, Doc Giffen was Earth. He was there for 50 years, and I have such high regard for the man. And I really said to my wife, I said, this is could be dangerous. I said, if Doc doesn't like this book, we're going to have to leave town.
How is Doc now? I would have thought that even more than family almost, he was closer than a brother to Arnold Palmer. I would have thought that Arnold's loss, both professionally and personally, would have been so devastating that it would have been hard for Doc to bounce back. How is he doing now? What is he doing?
He's doing great. You know, I still see him for lunch once in a while, and Doc and I are both fans of Survivor, which struck me as very odd that he likes Survivor like I do. But we always get together and talk about Survivor on Thursday afternoons, and he's doing good. I think the reason that it didn't devastate him was because he had such a great relationship with him for so many years that he'd done everything he could, you know, that there was nothing left in the tank, and he lost his friend, and he was devastated by that, but he moves on. But I'm glad you bring him up. You know, he's just a great man. I'm very fond of him. When, a lot of times when people would say, what's it like to work with a legend, I would go right to Doc Giffen and say, Doc Giffen is great to work with.
I've been around celebrities in the music business and in the movie and TV business and in the athletic arenas for the better part of 20 or 30 years. And I have seen a lot of people who were very famous and very successful who were very uncomfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
I don't think, maybe with the exception of Garth Brooks,
yeah, that's a good analogy.
I have ever met anyone who enjoyed being who they were more than Arnold Palmer enjoyed being Arnold Palmer. Do you think that's a fair statement? That no one loved being who they were more than him?
Yeah, that's a great point. He never ducked from celebrity, you know, that people would come up and see him in the streets and say, there's Arnold Palmer. He never minded taking pictures with people, and that he reveled in being who he was, and he was just so happy. There's a story that one of the women who worked at the halfway house said 2 weeks before he died, he was sitting out in his golf cart on number 10 hole by himself, and it was twilight, and she said she looked at him, and he had just had this smile on his face. He was all by himself looking around at the trees and the golf course that he had built and maintained for all these years, and she said he just looked so at peace with himself, and that's an image I like to have of him, that he was, you know, toward the end of his life, 2 weeks away, in fact, and he just was so content with all he'd done. And he was really a great man. We really miss him still every day.
Chris Riddell is the author of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. The entire focus of your book is Arnold Palmer and his life in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. I know he spent several months a year, you know, down at Bay Hill, but the majority of the time he loved to live right there, just a few hundred yards from where he grew up in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. And I would think on the surface, for those that don't know, and this may get back to the point of Arnold being so comfortable in his own skin, that one would think someone that famous that they would want to stay close to home because it would give them a sense of being grounded and they would feel like no one would ask anything of them. And on the surface, maybe, but Arnold Palmer, I almost get the idea he would have been offended if he didn't have things asked of him, if the Rotary Club didn't come to him and ask for a donation for the high school, if those things didn't happen, that would have bothered Arnold more, right?
Oh, that's a good point. You know, he was happy to help these community organizations, and he had the means to do it. And the one reverend that said, after he passed away, he goes, what we're going to miss most is he always cut the check. You know, you would go up and ask him to help you out, and he would always sign a check, some donation. There's a story about a shop with a cop that the state police do to help with kids. And he thought he would get $5,000 from Mr. Palmer, and he ended up getting $50,000. And he said, Mr. Palmer, can I release this to the public and let the papers know? And he said, no, let's just keep that between you and me. But he completely funded the program for 5 years out, and it's self-sustaining, and nobody knew about it.
How many stories like that did you come across of all the things we know about Arnold? And they are well documented. All you need to do is look at the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Children in Orlando. Yeah. And there's hospitals all over the country that show his magnanimous charity. But how many of the stories like that with the shop with the cop did you find? The stories that no one knows.
I thought I knew him pretty well. I interviewed him over 100 times over 20 years, studied him, knew people that knew him. But until I sat down and got to talk to the people that helped me write this book, I didn't know him the way I thought I did. He was incredibly generous and incredibly giving of his time. And, you know, he would the most important person in the world was the person that was right in front of him. He would talk to that person. There's a great story that Sam Saunders told at the memorial. He called him up, and Mr. Palmer answered the phone. He said, "Where are you? Or who are you talking to?" He said, "I'm talking to the president." And Sam said, "The president of what?" And he said, "The president of the United States." He goes, "Why did you answer the phone in the Oval Office?" He said, "Because I wanted to talk to you." You know, he just had a great appreciation of one-on-one human relationships.
I'm glad you brought up the memorial service. You were there. You were in the cathedral when that was going on.
Yeah.
And you brought up something else, and I thought of this, and I spoke with my son about it last weekend when we bumped into Jim Nance here at Quail Hollow. Jim Nance is great at what he does.
Yes.
His best moment, and you mentioned this in the book, his best moment, in my opinion, that he's ever had were the 15 minutes that he spent in front of that group at Arnold Palmer's memorial service.
It was wonderful, wasn't it?
All I could think was, not only is this wonderful, but selfishly, I'm thinking, whoever's got to follow Jim Nance, they need just to just walk up there and say, "I loved Arnold," and walk off. Because you're going to just pale by comparison. Look, I was bawling like a baby in my living room. There couldn't have been a dry eye in the house.
Yeah. Nance said he was more nervous about that than any of the Super Bowls he's ever done.
Look, to me, and I realize I'm a golfer, but to a lot of people in the world, I mean, this was a man who dined with queens and dined with people in pool halls. It was a more important audience and a wider audience than he may have ever had for a Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah, probably. Tom Ridge said that, and Tom Ridge is the former governor of U.S., a Vietnam veteran, and the Department of Secretary of Homeland Defense. He said it was the greatest memorial he's ever been to. He said that it should be taped and shown in schools on how to memorialize someone and who deserves that kind of memorial. I said I think it would be better as a Broadway play.
It was incredibly moving. It really was. And having been around Vince Gill for the last 25 years, and you brought up him, Vince Gill was exactly who Vince Gill is, and just so on point. Chris Rodell has written a book called Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about some of the fun stuff in the book. Talk to me about Arnold's dog and the tennis ball.
Well, that was one of the first times I interviewed him, and I was very nervous. I still had this reverence for him. And that was the time I was able to understand how to connect with him on a juvenile level that he enjoyed. Well, I was up there, and he was signing autographs, and he spent 3 hours every day signing autographs from people from all over the world and sending them back. And I was doing a story about golfers and their dogs, and I said, "What's an old rule stickler like you doing with a dog named Mulligan?" And he said, "You know, there's nothing wrong with a Mulligan. We have that's our rule here at the club. You're allowed to take a Mulligan on the first tee." I said, "Is he a good on-course dog?" He said, "No, he's lousy. He said, he chases after balls and slobbers them up." He said, "It's probably because I spend an hour every day out here hitting a tennis ball with a wedge into the net, and he chases after him." And I just thought, I go, man, would that be special. I said, "I'd like to see that." And he put his pen down. He got a gleam in his eye, and he said, "Come on." And it was like we were playing hooky, you know, just like you were running away from school. His duties were over. And he was sitting there. And then during that next 25 minutes or so, we just bantered. You know, we talked sports. We talked politics. And I just thought, this is my moment. You know, I can say that I had this time with Arnold Palmer. Little did I know I'd be fortunate enough to spend many, many hours like that with him later. But that was a special moment to watch him with a pitching wedge hitting a tennis ball and watching this dog soar after it in his backyard.
Chris, I was thinking about a meeting that I had with a radio station owner that I was working for when I was 22 years old, and he took me out to eat to Steak and Ale, and I thought, wow, this is the nicest place I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
And he ordered us steaks, and he ordered me a bourbon, and he ordered me a glass of red wine. And he sat them both in front of me, and I thought, okay, this is really, really odd. And he told me something. He said, "Son, you need to be as comfortable in the boardroom with this high-dollar wine as you are in the back room with this whiskey."
Yeah.
And I don't think I can think of anyone in sports who better epitomized being comfortable in both worlds and being equally accepted in both worlds as Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, the working title of the book for a long time was One Part Champagne, Three Parts Beer. Because people were asking me, you know, how was I feeling when he died? And I said, I feel one part despair, three parts euphoria. Despair because he's gone, euphoria because I got to spend time with him. And that is all a play on the Arnold Palmer tea, which is one part lemonade, three parts tea. But I said, Arnold Palmer, the man, was like Latrobe. He was one part champagne, three parts beer. You can have that range of socialization. You can literally have drinks with the Queen on one night, and then the next night be at the town hall, fire hall, drinking with the guys down there.
You mentioned dining with the Queen or perhaps having a beer at the Tin Lizzie. This is a man who was a member at Augusta National, could get on any golf course in the world he wanted at a moment's notice with a snap of his fingers. Yet you called him a lazy golfer, and I love this. It wasn't about his work ethic or his habits. It was that he was just as happy walking across the street to Latrobe Country Club.
Yeah, that always irritated me. I said, if I had his means, I would be at Pebble Beach on Monday. I would be at Augusta on Tuesday. I would be at all these places. I'd never be home. And I said to him, I said, you know, you could play Laurel Valley right down the street, 15 minutes. You could play Oakmont. It's an hour away. Or if you wanted, you could get in your plane, fly to Augusta, and be back by dinner. I said, why do you play Latrobe day after day? He said, it's just so close. And I love that. You know, there's no pretension about him at all. I marched it off. It was 1,987 paces from his front door. And I swear, if there was a course that was 1,986 paces from his front door, he'd play that instead.
One of the great questions you can ask someone of Arnold Palmer's success in the game of golf is, when was the last time you paid for blank? In other words, when was the last time you paid for golf balls? When was the last time you bought a golf club? When was the last time you paid greens fees? And I love this story the most, because the last time someone made Arnold pay greens fees was it's one of the bucket list courses in America, and he never went back.
Yeah, it was Bandon Dunes. And they went out there to play. They'd heard so much about it. I've never played it either. And he'd heard so much about it. And they went to the clubhouse, and they said, that'll be $100, Mr. Palmer. And he was very surprised. And I speculated he paid less than any man on earth to play that much golf, because his father was a green superintendent, so he played free then. In college, he played free, and then in the service, and then as a professional. And they said that became like a tagline out there, that they even charge Arnold Palmer out there. But he said he'd never go back.
Chris Rodell has written a book, Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. You spent many, many hours talking with Arnold Palmer. Part one of the question, did you ever have a point in all of those years when you were sitting there that you forgot that you were talking to one of the most famous people on the planet and in the game, and it was just some guy you knew? Or were you always aware?
No, it would drift in and out. You know, like, I was raised by the son of one of these Arnie's Army guys that just absolutely revered him. And so I carried that with me, that I had my father as ghost haunting me, saying, don't you screw this up. Don't offend Mr. Palmer. But then there's the line I use that I can't really say on the radio. I said, I just want you to know how much I enjoy hearing your insights, Mr. Palmer. And he said, I enjoy you coming in here and blowing so much sweet smoke. And he said a description of where the smoke went. And I thought, man, this guy is just like my buddies at the bar down the street. And he is so much a Latrobe guy. And one of the things I love about him, he was worth about $800 million when he died. And he would have been treated just the same as if he was worth $800 in this town. People wouldn't have treated him any differently. They'd have been still happy to see this joyful, cheerful, determined, bold man walk into the bar. Arnie's here. And that's the way it was, no matter what he was worth.
Outside of any recordings you have of interview sessions or any notes you have from interview sessions, is there something that you have, a memento, if you will, of the times that you spent with Arnold Palmer that means more to you than any other?
Well, I just got one, in fact, posthumously. A week ago. Prior to that, it was a picture of me interviewing him with Doc in the background. These interviews were just so much fun, so much bantering. And I remember Doc said after Mr. Palmer had passed, he goes, well, I guess that's all done for. And I said, no, I have an idea. Seance. But we didn't go that far. But just recently, somebody gave me the hat and the golf glove that was on his cart since the last time he drove it. And that hat, to put that on my head, they said how much they liked the book and they wanted me to have this, and I was just thrilled with it. You know, I don't know whether I want to wear it or preserve it in a museum-type display, but I was very touched by that, to have that last hat that Arnold Palmer wore on a golf course.
Hey, that's Chris Rodell, author of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. I hope you also enjoyed our conversations with John Feinstein about his book, The Prodigy, and Tim Scott, whose work, Ben Hogan, The Myths Everyone Knows and The Man No One Knew, is a must-read for Hogan fans. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim, featured there right now. Links to articles on an 81-year-old man who recently made two holes in one in a round, Brandel Chamblee's list of the 10 greatest golf seasons ever, and on putter fitting, which we probably all should do, especially if you putt like me. Weather-wise, perfect summer weekend in the Carolinas to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.